The verse, "You cannot serve God and mammon," I had difficulty with that, and I thought several different things about it along the way. But what that absolutely means is this. I mean, the absolute basic root meaning of what that expression typifies, pictures, describes. It means that you cannot serve both simultaneously. You can serve mammon, you can serve God, but you cannot serve them simultaneously. Now that means simply this. He said, "For in me, that in me you might have peace." If you serve Jesus Christ as his child, and you submit to baptism, which is his commandment, and you put yourself in church and try to do what God wants, you're going to have tribulation in the world. That's it. On the other hand, if you get saved, and then after you're saved, you submit to baptism, and you don't want to serve God faithfully in his church, and you just say, "Well, I've got better things to do," then you're going to have tribulation with Jesus Christ. So it's a question of which one you want tribulation with. The only way you can have peace with Jesus Christ is to be in fellowship with God through him. Now, I'm in spiritual union with Christ and have been for 55 years. But to stay in a daily fellowship relationship, I have to daily serve Jesus Christ. And if I don't, I've got tribulation with him. He bothers me. On the other hand, if I serve the world, I'm at peace with the world, but I'm at odds with Jesus Christ. It simply means you cannot serve both of them simultaneously. Now, I'm going to continue talking about end-time events, and I know a lot of you may not remember where we started all this, but this was something I made up a long, long time ago, and I told you when I started this series, what I was going to do in this series was go through the different phases that have to do with end-time events. Phase one, God prepares the land of Israel for the millennial reign of his son. You see 17 scriptures there, starting off with Ezekiel 38:18-20, and ending up with Isaiah 35:1-2. We've already finished that phase. God prepares the land of Israel for the millennial reign of his son. And we're in phase two and have been there for some time. I just wanted to remind you where we were. Now, phase two, the Son of God returns to end the Battle of Armageddon and to cleanse the heavenlies for the beginning of his millennial reign. Now, we've covered verses 1 through 7. There are actually 25 verses in this altogether. Starts off with Revelation 1:7, ends up with Ezekiel 39:1-7, and 17-22. We've covered the first 8 verses. We've covered Revelation 1:7, Matthew 24:30, Luke 21:26-27. Revelation 16:16-19, Ezekiel 38:18-20, Zechariah 14:1-7, and 2 Thessalonians 1:6-10. Now, later on, we're going to continue with Jude 14:15, if we can get to it today. And we're going to go right on into phase 3, and then I've got another sheet, and eventually we'll go on into phase 4 of all this, and hopefully we may finish this before the Lord comes. This is phase 4, and then we have phase 5. That way I'm going to take you through the whole escapade, everything that has to do with right now through the tribulation period. Before I made this up early this morning when I first got back, I just barely got it finished before I came over here, so I may have some grammatical errors in here, may have some misspelling errors, but I wanted to set you up for the second coming of Christ, and I told you we were going to discuss when he comes and comes through the cloud. I hope we're able to get that in this morning. We're going to talk about the second advent of Christ. Now, whenever you hear preachers use this expression, second advent of Christ, they are not talking about the rapture. The rapture occurs before this. The rapture is also called the first resurrection. The second advent of Christ is different from when he comes and catches out all the saved. It's when he comes back with them later on at the end of the tribulation period, and every eye shall see him. That's his coming to the earth at the end of the tribulation period to rule and reign. The second advent of Christ. Now, there's a comma, and there's a lot of stuff in between it, and that far down at the bottom begins the millennium. So if you read this, the second advent of Christ begins the millennium, you get the gist of it, and you have to read pretty fast between the commas. The second advent of Christ, which happens at the end of the tribulation period, following the rapture, first resurrection, that happens during the tribulation period, begins the millennium. So it's his coming at the end that begins his millennial reign. Some very terrible things are going to be happening just before that and during that time. Now, in Zechariah 14, 4 through 7, we've already covered this. Matter of fact, we covered all this last Sunday, so I'll just read it. Zechariah 14, 4 through 7. And his feet shall stand that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and that shall be a very great valley, and half the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. And ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of mountains shall reach into Azazel, which is on the other side of the Mountain of Olives. Yea, ye shall flee, like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Now here comes the second advent. And the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee. He's raptured them out previously. Here he comes back with them. It's at the very end of the tribulation period. Last Sunday, I went into articulate detail to describe what caused verse 6 and 7. And this will come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known of the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. We covered exactly what produces that. The phenomena will be caused by the tremendous building in of a cloud shield above the tropopause level in the stratosphere. We went through all the charts and diagrams last week. Now we're going to go back before this. We've already covered Zechariah 14, 4 through 7. Now let's go all the way back in the previous chapter to verse 8, and then we'll come down to verse 3, just before Zechariah 14, 4, so we can see what's going to happen just before the Mount of Olives splits, or in the first part of the tribulation period. Zechariah 13, 8. And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts shall be cut off and die. We're going from Zechariah 13, 8, right on through verse 9, which ends the chapter, into chapter 14 and down to verse 3. Remember, there were no chapter divisions in the original writing. And it came to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. Now, and I will bring the third part through the fire, and refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call upon my name, and I will hear them, and I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God. A third of Israel is going to be brought through the tribulation period. Now, I can't tell you that exact number, but I'll simply say this. At the present time, the population of all of Israel, all different groups included, is just a little over 6 million, and it's growing. Now, of that 6 million, 4.8 million are Jewish. So if you take 4.8 million and divide it by a third, that means if the Antichrist attacked today and the battle began in the middle of the tribulation period, which is the last 3.5 years, there would be about 1.6 million Jews that would be able to flee into the Negev wilderness in the southern part of Israel, which is almost half of it, and there they would be protected for 3.5 years. Zechariah 14, 1 through 3. Now, notice he begins to tell what happens when the Antichrist attacks Israel. This is before the splitting of the Mount of Olives, earlier in the tribulation period. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoils shall divide in the midst of thee. Jerusalem is in the midst of Israel. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem. Here's what happens to Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Now, here's the point that I wanted to make. We're getting down into the tribulation period. The city of Jerusalem has been overrun. For 3.5 years, the Lord fights for Israel. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. The final battle of Armageddon is when the Lord Jesus Christ ends the war as he returns at the second advent at the end with all the saints, and that ends 3.5 years of war that had preceded it, which began when the Antichrist overran Jerusalem. Now we're going to take a look next at go back to the 12th chapter, verses 8 through 14, and remember, we've just left the point in verse 3, then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. We're going back to chapter 12, and we're going to pick up right there when the Lord begins to fight for Israel. Zechariah 12, 8 through 14. In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God, and the angel of the Lord before them. Now the angel of the Lord is going to go forth and fight for them for 3.5 years, finally completely defend and finally deliver the nation of Israel when Christ returns to end the battle of Armageddon, destroy 5/6 of the Antichrist army according to Ezekiel 39, and also to take the Antichrist and the false prophet and throw them into the lake of fire burning with brimstone, according to the last two or three verses in the 19th chapter of Revelation. Now notice what he says when he goes forth to fight before them in verse 9. And this shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Now, at the end of it, he splits the Mount of Olives, but this is where he's fighting during the tribulation period. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications. This is when all Israel turns back to their God, and they realize how gracious God has been to them. He has allowed them to once again become his people, and then they will receive the Messiah they rejected some 2,000 years before, but this time they will be in supplication to the Spirit of God, the veil that's over their heart mentioned in the 13th chapter of 3rd chapter of 2 Corinthians, the last few verses, will be lifted, and they will receive Christ as their Savior. That will be at the very end of the tribulation period. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. They will realize at this time the grace of the cross. For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but to us which are saved, it is the power of God. The Jews did not receive him. They crucified him. They pierced him. Now when he comes back, finally they realize the horrible mistake they've made. They receive him as Messiah. And the whole nation goes into a period of mourning. We're beginning the millennial reign right here. He's returned. The spirit of grace and supplications has come upon him. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. If you were to lose your firstborn, your first child was to die. The first child has a very special meaning to virtually every parent. It's just different from the other children. And so there is a great bitterness if you lose your firstborn, or if you've never had any children, and your firstborn child dies. It's much worse on a mother that doesn't have any children when she loses her firstborn. In that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem. Now he mentions a mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the valley of Megiddo. That's Tel Megiddo, the plain of Ezra-Elon, the plain of Jezreel, where the final battle of Armageddon is to be fought. In that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem as the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the valley of Megiddo. This is referring back to the time when King Josiah, against God's instruction, went against Pharaoh Necho up in that valley, the valley of Megiddo. And there Josiah, who was one of the most popular kings of Israel and a very fine man, who restored the law to Israel and was beloved of God, there, because he disobeyed the commandments of God and went up to fight when he was not supposed to, he lost his life. The nation of Israel greatly bemoaned him, and there was a great mourning in the valley of Hadad-Rimmon. There's going to be another one when they realize what they've done to their Messiah. Now, when Jesus comes back, every eye at the end of the tribulation period will see him on this earth, which is what I told you I was going to talk about. Well, the thing about it is, he's not going to stay visible to Israel throughout the millennial reign. He's going to become visible again when they have completed the temple. In Ezekiel chapters 40 through 43, it gives the explicit instructions as to how to build it. And in Ezekiel, the 43rd chapter, you'll discover he makes his triumphant entry in through that constructed building as the Shekinah glory of God. He'll go into the building. I don't think they'll see him for 1,000 years. And they'll worship him in spirit and in truth. They'll worship him by faith, not being able to see him. Here they don't see him, but they have seen him come back before this at the second advent. And now they're mourning because of what they did 2,000 years before, but rejoicing that now they know he is the true Messiah. And the land shall mourn. Every family apart, all the nation of Israel will mourn. What has come through the tribulation period? The family of the house of David and their wives apart. The Jews have always worshipped separately. We Gentiles have great trouble with it. We really shouldn't have all that much trouble with it, because it carried over and perpetrated into our society. When I was a young man, I was raised in the hills of northern Arkansas in the church that my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Henry Michael Murray, organized in 1843 in his living room. It is now a very fine structure, has stood for all this time, and still stands for the truth. On one side, they had a door in the front that the men went in. On the other side, they had one where the women went in. The men and the women sat separately. It wasn't a separatist type thing. It wasn't a legalistic thing. The women enjoyed it. The men enjoyed it. Back then, you didn't have bakers, lawyers, thieves, all these different things, but doctor, lawyer, merchant, chief. It was just a simple rural community way back in the middle of nowhere. So most of the people were farmers, and everybody had things in common. The men would sit over there before church and discuss the crops, what kind of crops they were having, what the weather was doing, who was running for political office. The women would sit over on their side, and they'd talk about quilts, knitting quilts, different things. They had conversations that they carried on. It was a very simple life. It was a very wonderful life. If somebody's barn burned down, we went over and rebuilt it. If somebody had a bad crop, we brought out stuff at the storm cellar, and our storm cellar is where we stored it, and we gave it to them, and they got through the year, even if they weren't members of the church. It was a thing that was done, and there was tremendous harmony. True, we didn't have a whole lot of fun. Exciting day for us was not to have to work and sit out on the front porch and watch the grass grow. That was exciting. Well, that may seem like a very simple life to you, but it's a very enjoyable life. Now, the Jews have always worshipped separately. I speak conversational Hebrew. How are you, ladies and gentlemen? I spent a great deal of time studying the Jewish culture. I learned how to speak conversational Hebrew so I could learn from the Jews and I could understand how they worshipped and why they worshipped. Even today, if you go to Jerusalem and you go to the Temple Mount, you will discover that on one side, in front of the Wailing Wall, they have a place for women. And on the other side, they have a place for men. It's still the way they worship. They're not going to stop that way of worship. It isn't that God felt women were inferior to men. I'm just going to give you an opinion, and it's no more, no less than opinion. I think God chose men to preach because we're the worst of the two. Now, that may wound your chauvinist pride, but I think he picked the worst one of the two to preach because we are the weakest when it comes right down to it. Now, Eve was tricked. I'm not making excuses for the women. Eve was tricked. She was deceived. And women are very easily deceived. You say, well, that's terrible. That insults their intelligence. Oh, no. I know just how to deceive them. All you've got to do is tell a woman in her 70s that she looks like she's 40 and she'll light up like a Christmas tree. All you've got to do is ask them if you think they've lost weight. They say, you look like you've lost a lot of weight. You say, well, Brother Michael Murray, that's God. No. That's the way you deceive women. So it's very easy. But you say, well, Brother Michael Murray, do you do that? No. But I know how. I've had the Dale Carnegie course on how to win friends, influence people, and lead women around by the nose. You say, well, Brother Michael Murray, that's terrible. You're insulting their intelligence. No. Blame Dale Carnegie. Women are a lot smarter than me. I've taught school for years. And I know that women are more intelligent, basically. They have a certain instinct about things that men don't have. Adam knew exactly what he was doing. Eve was tricked. But Adam could see that Eve had changed. And he wanted her more than he wanted God. He made a deliberate, willful choice. And so whenever God chose men to preach the gospel, it's not because we're big, strong, chauvinist, super intelligent human beings. It's because I think we're the worst of the lot of the two. And I think God chose the weakest thing. I know the Bible says the women are weakest, but it's talking about physical strength. But you go around the missionary Baptist churches across this country and you'll discover that the men don't come and the women do, and you'll discover it wasn't for the women, we wouldn't have very many churches. And I'm trying to patternize women and get on your good side. I'm just trying to tell the way it is. Now, the reason the house of David and the wives apart, David was king. Now, in Israel, there were two different types. There were several different types, but basically there was a priesthood, and then there was a kinghood. You had rulers that were kings, and you had priests that served God in the temple. And the land shall mourn every family apart, the family of David apart, he was the king, and their wives apart. They worship separately, and they're not going to change that millennial reign. The family of the house of Nathan apart. Now, Nathan was a prophet. David had two sons, Solomon and Nathan, and Nathan was the prophet. So here we have the prophet worshiping apart, descended from that line. And we have also the priesthood. Levi was the one out of whose loins Aaron came, and Aaron was the man who was the head of the priest. In Israel, they're working right now very diligently on DNA to determine who the true priests are and who the bloodline actually represents in the people. The DNA of the tribe of Levi has certain characteristics that other tribes don't have. And particularly if you're a descendant of Aaron, and if you find a man in our culture, Jewish, named Cohen, Cohen actually is the name that was commonly attributed to the priesthood, and that's what the Jewish derivation of the word actually means. The family of the house of Levi apart and their wives apart, the family of Shammai apart, this is another part of the priesthood that descended through Zadok, and their wives apart. All the families that remain, every family apart and their wives apart. So this is going to be a time when the Lord Jesus Christ returns and there is a period of great mourning. Now for those of you that haven't been here previously to this, I'm a geologist. I'm a synoptic analyst. I retired from the National Security Agency in 1971. And when I got out and came back into our work, I was amazed in the Bible to discover the various aspects of the things that God said would be happening in the tribulation period. So I've already gone back through all this, spent a great deal of time on it to prove that what I'm saying is true. When God made the atmosphere, God made it in a certain way. He put the lower section today, which we call the troposphere. It has a fair amount of oxygen in it. The closer you get to ground, the more oxygen there is to breathe. It thins as you go up. In the Bible, it's known as the area where the birds fly, inferring that there's enough oxygen to draw breath. Then there was a second heaven, the heaven where the sun, moon, and stars existed. And then there was a third heaven where God dwelled, and they're all under the same Greek word, Uranos. Now, when God made our atmosphere, he made the troposphere, and then right up at the top of it, he put a little inversion of temperature, a rather large inversion of temperature, actually, called the tropopause. It is a pause where tremendous temperature inversion exists just before you go up into the stratosphere. In the stratosphere, the temperature starts to fall off. If I went straight up over here, would I find a tropopause, a temperature inversion of the tropopause level? Yes. If I went straight up at the North Pole, would I find a tropopause? Yes. If I went up over Tucumcari, New Mexico, would I find a tropopause? Yes. If I went over up over Bangor in Maine, would I find a tropopause? Matter of fact, if I went up from any point over this earth, would I find a tropopause? Yes. In some places, you might even find three. But there's definitely a tropopause up there where the temperature inversion goes out. God made the Earth's atmosphere to where when you heat the air, it rises and it cools, it expands at the rate of 1 degree Celsius for every 100 meters it is lifted. Unfortunately, you do not have, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, you do not have enough natural heating, either by lifting along the front or by convection, the actual heating of the ground, to force clouds to go up through the tropopause level into the stratosphere. They just can't break it. If you had some mechanical device that would blow through it from the earth that had enough force, you could blow it up through the tropopause level. Now, the kicker in all this is, whenever you have a volcanic eruption, the force from the volcanic eruption flows through this temperature inversion. Now, you know if you heat air and it's cooler above it, the air will rise. Well, what happens is the air rises in the troposphere until it gets to the tropopause level. It hits this inversion, it can't rise. You've got to have a mechanical force to blow through it. Only volcanic eruptions can do that. Well, why is it important to the formation of a cloud in the stratosphere? For this reason, you have considerable moisture down the troposphere, the lowest level. And any time you see a smoke cloud and you watch it and it disappears, what's happening is this. On each one of those tiny little particles called hygroscopic nuclei, little particles of salt, dust, 101 other things, once the moisture condenses on that little particle, it becomes heavy enough to where it doesn't float anymore and falls back to the ground, and the smoke cloud disappears. But that isn't true above the tropopause level. In the stratosphere, which is above the tropopause level, once you blow through there and create a cloud there, there's virtually no moisture there. Unfortunately, the cloud stays suspended there for a prolonged period of time. The jet stream is just below the tropopause, and above it, the winds gradually shift up in the stratosphere. Instead of going west to east, they go east to west. I have proven there will be a cloud built in above the tropopause level in the stratosphere, and all the volcanic eruptions and terrible things that will be happening in the tribulation period will produce this cloud. If you're here for the first time, I can understand why this might seem like so much humbo-jumbo and jargon. But I want you to know I've covered this material and I've presented it in over 700 Missionary Baptist churches. You say, why do you mention Missionary Baptist churches? Missionary Baptist churches and the people that make them up are the most stubborn, mule-headed people on the surface of God's earth. And I'm still alive after 22 years of doing this. So I present the proof. Our preachers have checked it out. It's been checked out by the Tennessee Valley Authority and lots of other scientists, and I guarantee you that it does create a cloud up there, and it's very real. I explained and showed to you how all over the earth, at some places it would still be light, at other places it would be dark. I went into a meticulous detail of that. Well, what about the second coming of Jesus Christ? This cloud will definitely be built in. I showed you hundreds of scriptures to prove it. I went into great articulous detail to prove every word I said. I've done that now for about 6 weeks. When Jesus returns, how can every possible eye on the earth see? When the same God who made the earth and made the earth's atmosphere made it, he made it and put in it certain laws. Now, God can break those laws. He doesn't have to follow them. When you turn water into wine, that's an absolute miracle. It does not involve using what's already here. You have to set aside all the laws, and God does it. That's absolutely, completely, utterly miraculous. It has no foundation whatsoever in manipulating anything that's already here. But when you deal with a lot of God's miracles, he uses things that he has already made to produce them, and only he could do it. So it's an absolute miracle. Now, God put a lot of laws in physics. I teach physics, chemistry. I'm certified to teach earth science, physics, chemistry, and all that possess. Now, if you take different laws God put into the law in physics involving optical illusions, you have the laws of refraction, the laws of reflection, the laws of scattering, the law of superior image, the law of inverse image. If you put all that together and they do all functions, then you can explain why, if you're driving out in Texas and you're down around El Paso, Texas, and you look up in the sky and you're down around El Paso and you see Amarillo. There he is in the sky. And it actually is Amarillo. I mean, the same buildings, it's a perfect image of Amarillo. How can this happen? When all these laws function together, and only God has the ability to make them function together, they produce a duplication, a picture of something that's a long way off. When Christ breaks through the cloud, every one of these laws will be functioning. It will be possible for his image to have been transmitted all the way around the earth. Now, you say, well, that's just theoretical. It may be theoretical, but it's based on laws. And it can very well happen, and I believe will. I don't think Jesus is going to come back and every eye sees him because he flies around like Superman here. I think when he makes his penetration through this single cloud, every eye on the surface of the earth is going to see him. I had great difficulty in understanding this, but gradually and eventually with time, I think I have got an understanding of it. But I guarantee you, this will work. And I guarantee you, only God can do it. But it's within the laws that he made. Now, we're going to take a look at Jesus. We know the last time the First New Testament church showed him was in the book of Acts, when he ascended out of their sight and went up into a cloud. With all this in mind, and remembering that he can be actually transmitted, his very image, all over the earth, let's take a look at the scriptures that have to do with the second advent, the coming of the Lord at the end. In Acts chapter 1, verses 9 through 11, and when he had spoken these things, while they beheld, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. He disappeared in a cloud. He's going to come back in a cloud. And every eye on this earth will see him. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, which also said, ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing into heaven? This same Jesus which is taken up from you into heaven shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go into heaven. Shall so come in like manner as you have seen him go into heaven. He descended in a cloud. They saw him go up in a cloud. They're going to see him come back in a cloud. You say, well, how can everybody on the earth see it? Only God can do it. And all these laws have to function and work together, but it is perfectly possible. It is absolutely within the laws that God himself made, and he can operate within his own laws and bring this to pass. And in Matthew 26, we're told, Jesus saith unto him, thou hast said, nevertheless I say unto you, now he's speaking to the high priest, hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. This inference is reverberated over and over again throughout the Bible, coming in the clouds of heaven. Now Revelation 1:7. Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him. How can that happen? When he breaks through the cloud, the laws of superior image, inverse image, refraction, reflection, scattering, all these laws function together can do it. And they can do it within the very laws that God made. But nobody could produce this except God. And they also which pierced him. This is the nation of Israel. And all kindreds of the earth shall wail because of him. This is not when he comes to catch out the saved. This is not the time when the saved are all drawn up into heaven. This is the second advent when he comes back with those same saved that he's raptured out before. And now the ones that are left on the earth that have been through the tribulation period have been through a literal living hell on this earth. There's a terrible price to pay. And it's interesting who these people might be, but I'm not going to go into that because that's a whole different subject. Matthew 24:27. This is the second coming. This is the second advent of Christ. And as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. When lightning starts on a distant horizon, it travels all the way across the horizon. This is the final battle of Armageddon. For wherever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. This is the final battle of Armageddon. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, the stars shall fall from heaven, the powers of heaven shall be shaken. You won't be able to see the sun because of this cloud around the entire earth anywhere. You won't be able to see the moon or the stars. This cloud will have been well established and built in the tribulation period, as I've shown you repeatedly. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. This is when he breaks through the cloud. That's the sign of the Son of Man in heaven at the very end of the tribulation period. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, for they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. There are far too many scripture references to validate the existence of this cloud, and I've shown you how it will form for the last six Sundays. Luke 21:26-27. Men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, but the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud, singular, one huge cloud around the earth. with power and great glory. God describes this end time quite aptly. Zephaniah 1:14, the great day of the Lord is near, it is near and hasteneth greatly, even the voice of the day of the Lord. The mighty man shall cry there bitter. That day is a day of wrath, a day of trouble and distress, a day of wasteness and desolation, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness. For behold, Micah 4:1-3, for behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, yea, and all the proud that do wickedly shall be stubble, and the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise, with healing in his wings, and ye shall go forth and draw up his calves of the stall. When he departed Israel, he said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest and stonest the prophets and them that are sent unto thee, often would I have gathered you under my wings as a mother hen gathered chicks, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For you shall not see me henceforth, till you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. That's when he comes at the end. And ye shall tread down the wicked, but they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. I can't really give you a picture. I'm not an artist, and I have a difficult time drawing. I've had graphic engineering, but I couldn't draw naturally, saving a lot. I think this is probably the closest thing I've found to what I expect it to look like. I think the Shekinah glory of God will proceed from a distance from the earth and come in, and then he'll break through the clouds. That song, we shall behold him in all his glory. And he'll break through that cloud, and that'll be the end of the tribulation period and the beginning of the millennial reign of Christ. No charge for the vocal. Take a little break.